It was nice in the war, really. The shelters, the blackout, cups of tea.
The ARP, the evacuees, London kids seeing cows for the first time.
Old Churchill on the wireless, the 9 o'clock news. Vera Lynn singing away.
Spitfires and Harrigans and the blue sky over the cornfield. Those were the days.
Dave,
I am. I'm here, mate.
Good stuff. Right, so
I've got my serial killer porter here, my Black Panther.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I love it. It's so good.
Welcome to another episode of the Something Wicked podcast and its nuclear season.
Indeed.
Episode four. And what are we doing tonight, Dave?
We're doing Raymond Briggs. When the Wind Blows.
Correct.
Superb.
So, do you want to give us a brief synopsis of what it is?
So, basically, it is a what you would call a graphic, possibly a graphic novel or a graphic novella, really, or a cartoon book, which, of course, Raymond Briggs is famous for. He did Fungus the Bogeyman, didn't he? And, you know, known for his children's books. Brilliantly witty. But in this case,
the snowman
and the Father Christmas one as well that he did, but he's obviously very famous for the snowman, probably more than anything else, the snowman, you know, walking in the air and all that, right? But
it wasn't Alec Jones, was it? Apparently
not originally.
Not on the cartoon.
Jones just jumped on the bandwagon and had the hit, the twat. But King, that's what you get from Anglesey boys, you know what I mean? The thing is, however, this is probably Briggs's masterpiece, I think, because what he's done is taken this rather simple story of a couple, Jim and Hilda, a kind of slightly naive, late middle-aged...
Mildly.
Say again?
That's putting it mildly.
That is putting it mildly, especially Hilda, who is fucking stupid, really. Basically, it hasn't aged well in that respect, because in a way it's kind of quite sexist, really, towards Hilda, I think. But I think what it's trying to do is convey people who are of a pension age, pensioners during like the 1980s, who are trying to come to terms with this idea of potential nuclear apocalypse. Would you say that's not a bad?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that's right.
So, I suppose the story starts. There's this international incident happening, isn't there, between us and America and the Russians, us on the American side, of course, and there's real tension in the air. And James, who's retired, as is Hilda, he's sort of keeping abreast of things by going to the library and reading the newspapers. And he's coming home and he's telling a completely disinterested Hilda, who has no idea.
That's correct.
You know, I mean, there's one really good line where he says, oh, there might be a preemptive strike. And she's going on about, oh, well, not another strike, them bloody miners, this, that, and the other.
That's right, yeah.
She doesn't know anything. So James gets quite excited, doesn't he? Sort of a mix of anxiety and excitement, because he doesn't really know what is actually the reality that's going to hit them.
No.
But he's quite excited when he's getting his fallout shelter ready and he's painting his windows.
Yeah.
So it's quite...
of Hilda when she gets all the water bottles lined up, all the water.
Yeah, so it's a bit of an adventure for him and, you know, their quite dull life, really. You know, it is something a bit different, isn't it? But Hilda's just... It's quite sort of the start of the book. They're sort of pottering about, you know, they're having this dialogue between them, which is very affectionate. It's obviously
very affectionate.
They're really devoted to each other.
Then what happens, of course, they're having dinner, having sausages and chips and talking about the mundane things. And then there's this announcement on the radio. Shall I read this out?
Yeah.
The Prime Minister made a statement this afternoon in view of the deteriorating international situation, warning the country preparations are underway. Outbreak of hostilities, fallout shelters, 3 days' time. So it's jumping in and out of other bits of statement there. That's how it's written. Because what's great about Raymond Briggs and the way he tells his stories, because of course it's all done in cartoon style. It's all done like a Tintin novel, you know, would be. Mm. Or, I don't know what you would call that. Is it letterboxing? I don't know, you know. Yeah. But basically, this comes over the radio when they're having dinner. And of course, Jim realizes the consequences of this. And he's like, crumbs! Oh my God, you know. Yeah. But Hilda has no clue, you know. What's the matter, dear? Have you burnt yourself? She thinks. She thinks he's scalded himself on his sausage. Mm. But he realizes, and he's got his head in his hands saying, blimey, 3 days, 3 days. But then, like you say, Lee, they go on then, and Jim starts getting rather enthusiastic in making the little crappy fallout shelter before, which we've already talked about at length.
Yes. But it is a comment on the protect and survive, isn't it, Raymond?
Massively.
Really giving it.
It's a massive mistake out of protect and survive, really, yeah. I think.
What I love, though, is when the three-minute warning does actually go off and James shits himself.
Yeah.
And he's screaming at Hilda, it's the three-minute warning. And she goes, oh, dear, I'll just bring the washing in.
Yeah, yeah.
Which causes him to freak out and scream at her. And now, in the film, he actually calls her a stupid bitch. In the shelter, you stupid bitch.
Yeah, he doesn't call that. He goes, you idiot.
I think he calls her a fool.
I've got it in front of me, Lee. It says, come back, you stupid fool, and get in the shelter. Shut up. And he goes, how dare you talk to me like that, James? Shut up and get in. He says, you know, and in the end, because she's still protesting, he grabs her physically and yanks her underneath the door. Get in, get in, get in. And it's beautifully done because then it's kind of Oppenheimer-esque. Because the next page is two blank white pages, which I think is genius.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that is one of the best parts of the book, isn't it? You just see two blank pages with a bit of red around the edges.
Around the edges.
And then it's the following two, everything sort of comes into focus again, doesn't it?
Yes. Pink to red, back into focus. So it gives you that idea of the impact. Flipping back a little bit as well, after that conversation they have around the dinner table about the impending doom, 3 days and what have you, and before Jim starts making his fallout shelter, there is this brilliant picture of the missile, and the caption just says, meanwhile on a distant plane, ..
And that's another double page spread, isn't it?
Another double page spread, just give it, and it just shows you this cold, ominous, dark missile ready to go, ready to launch.
And because it's covering two pages as opposed to the small boxes, because there's loads of boxes on each page, isn't there? You know, Raymond Briggs has really crammed in lots of frames there. So it's a real contrast just to go to one picture spread over two pages, which I suppose shows the enormity of what's coming.
That's exactly it. You've nailed it. That's the creative artistry about this book, which Briggs has done brilliantly. It's like before the actual blast as well, and before Jim screams at Hilda to listen to him and stop being a bloody idiot, there's that picture as well of the submarine under the water. Again, grey, murky, misty, and it says, meanwhile in a distant ocean. Mm-hmm. So we're not sure whether the bomb that hits Hilda and Jim comes from the upstanding missile or from the submarine, because it's all encompassing, it's all out there, hidden away from most of us humans, and hidden away from small little lives like James and Hilda. But it's out there and it's ominous and it's going to kill you, you know. Amazing, brilliant, scary, fucking terrifying. You know.
I know. I mean, can you remember when you first came across it? Did you do it at school? Because I remember I did in probably English lesson.
I don't remember doing it at school. I think very fortunately, because I knew about it, and I may have seen the TV adaptation many years ago, but a good many years ago when George was little, my son George, I thought, oh, this would be a great thing for him to read when he's a little bit older. And I'm still trying to get him to read it now. Because he's 15 now, it's kind of probably seems a bit young for him. But when I was reading him the Tintin books and Asterix and stuff, it's probably not the kind of thing I wanted to read to him before he went to bed.
Yeah.
In a weird kind of way, this book was never written for children, I don't think. You know?
No, but it's funny that it found its way into schools, whereas I suppose Threads, which came, this was 82 it came out, wasn't it, the book? Yeah. The film came out in 85, I think, or 86. Which probably a lot of more people might have seen because it did get a cinema release, and then did pretty well on video. But it's interesting that kids might have seen Threads. I saw Threads, but I'm sure more kids found out about nuclear devastation by reading this because it was.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was on I think it was on like the curriculum or something like that.
It was. And you know what? We may have read it at school. I just don't. I don't quite remember it with myself reading at school. Yeah. But I mean, it's a genius. I mean, Briggs. It's a genius idea of Briggs's. And it's so important. I mean, he obviously felt it was so important. And it was so important. Why is it not so important now? This is what I don't understand.
I know.
Why did it feel so important back in 82?
Especially because graphic novels are dead popular now, more than ever, aren't they?
But we don't. Why do we not feel the nuclear threat now?
I don't know.
It's mad, isn't it? We're doing the six-parter, and it's kind of a nostalgia trip, really.
Yeah.
But really, we should feel more of a nuclear threat now
than
we did back in 82 and 85 and...
Exactly.
A lovely comic moment as well as the white turns to pink and then to orange and then things become slightly clearer and then you can just start seeing the door and the 2 feet popping out underneath the makeshift shelter up against the wall with the door and then you just have one little speech bubble going, "Blimey!"
Yeah. But then they think it's over, don't they? They think that wasn't that bad.
Exactly.
But then they see the devastation of the house. The house is completely turned upside down and Hilda's like really pissed off. And she wants to get out straight away to start clearing it up. But James says, no, the radiation, the fallout. And she has no idea what he's talking about. There's one good bit where James says, "I wonder if there's any radiation about." And Hilda says, "Well, I can't see any." But she thinks, and they're both very nostalgic about World War II, you know, the Blitz and everything and this all pulling together. And Hilda and James as well sort of makes mistakes along the way. But Hilda thinks, for one, that the Germans are the enemy again.
Yes.
And they just think it's going to be like World War II, you know, that they'll get through it. Stiff upper lip, government knows best, don't worry, dear, we'll get by.
It's like Monty will save us again.
Yeah.
Hang on, Monty.
Oh, he must be getting on now. Oh, yeah.
I think even then, I think he'd died, hadn't he? I think he'd... There's a picture of him. I'll just flip back and have a quick look, where they're talking about Monty. And, I mean, there's all these great bits here where they're talking about the Ruskies and looking at pictures of Hitler and Ruskies, and all these imaginings. And it's all Roosevelt and Churchill and Hitler, you know. So they're still living in the past. They're not aware of what's coming in the future, you know.
Yeah. I love quite early on before the bomb drops where James rings his son, Ron, who's living in London, isn't he, with his family.
That's right.
And trying to give him some advice or get some advice about the fallout shelter. And he finds out that Ron hasn't bothered to build one because Ron doesn't give a shit, does he? He knows he's dead.
Yeah.
He says, "Oh well, we live in London. There's certainly going to be a bomb here."
Yeah.
And he knows he's a goner, and he's sort of a bit delirious, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he's got a kid, you know. They've just had a baby, and
it's so tragic.
You know, that's pretty horrible. But you don't get to hear Ron or see him. You just hear James's side of the conversation. But James comes off a bit annoyed with him, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Saying, "Oh, he's not taking it seriously."
It's brilliantly tragic, the whole thing, you know, the way it's put together. It's a brilliant scenario because it's like the son is more nihilistic about his fate, and these two, it's all kind of stiff upper lip, isn't it? It's like, he's like, "Only the fittest will survive the outcome of a nuclear holocaust." This is what Jim's saying as he's getting inside his he's putting the mattress down inside his little shelter. They think they've got this Dunkirk spirit going on where they're going to survive it.
I think that's what Briggs wanted to do. I think he did base. Did he base them on his mum and dad? Or is that like...
Could well have done.
Because he wrote another book, didn't he, on his mum and dad? And I think he did say in one interview I've seen that he did base them on his mum and dad. And you're supposed to see them as innocent and naive, aren't you? Which they obviously are. But you do sometimes get annoyed with them, I find, that they are so stupid.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So, you know, and I think he did that deliberately because I have heard him call them stupid in an interview. I've heard him say they're simple people, you know, they're naive, they're living in the past and all this. But I think on other occasions he has used the word stupid.
I think this book is almost like a perfect. You could quote this as almost like a metaphor for films like Don't Look Up, which is really about the environment situation. You know, the film, yeah, Don't Go, where no one, yeah, believes that the meteorite's going to strike the Earth. And these scientists are imploring, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And no one believes it until they see it in the sky coming towards them, right? Yeah. Which I think is, whatever you think of that film, the idea is brilliant. Because it's the same as climate change, isn't it? It's like climate change. Nobody really wants to believe it until their fucking shed's halfway down the road because their house is flooded through, and a lot of old people, you know, they don't understand it, they don't get it. So what they'll do is they'll get the heating allowance and they'll run their fucking heating all day when they don't need it, not realizing that, you know, we have a different generation. We'll go, Jesus, no, we can't afford to do that. And two, we've got to try and preserve things a little bit more. So I think that equates brilliantly, because I think you'd find a lot of, you know, not obviously that, I'm stereotyping. There's a lot of older people who care tremendously about the environment. In fact, there's probably been a survey recently that I heard where it's apparently older people that do actually care next to the younger generation. They care the most.
Yeah, yeah.
But after saying that, that's not been my experience.
No.
You know, my experience has been that old people don't seem to give much of a shit, really.
Oh. Well, they won't be around to see it.
Most. Well, they don't. You know, they don't understand the idea of rewilding.
Like Brexit.
They voted Brexit, and they vote Tory. They keep voting Tory all the time. You know.
Don't let them vote. It was your idea, I think. Yeah, you said, where you should let old people vote if they paid off the house.
Yeah,
they've got a few pensions.
Yeah, yeah.
They shouldn't vote because they've got no.
I call it
staking things.
I call it Logan's Run politics, Lee. Logan's Run.
I did tell a few people at work, and a lot of them were like, oh yeah, I see. That's quite a good idea, actually.
I think 68 should be the cut off. You know, because most people have got a pension by then. You've lived your life, and that's it. Voting's out of the question for you then, because the world's about the younger people, you know. I stand by it. I really do.
Yeah, yeah.
I think because the majority of older people that you see, their interests are not the same as the rest of the population. They're just not. They're really not.
No.
And you can't blame that either, really. You know, at 55 now, I'm starting to feel like thinking, well, you know, my best years are behind me. There's a Steely Dan lyric, which is so beautiful. And it's so simply, and it goes, the time of my time has come and gone. And I thought, Jesus, it runs a shiver down my spine when I think about that line.
Yeah.
The time of my time has come and gone. Because I think Donald Fagen is like right up there with Morrissey when it comes to us as being like the great lyric writer, songwriter. He's genius. And I think in that one phrase sums it up. And like, you have your day. And you have your apex of your day. That's what that means.
That's right.
Your true moment, your real perfect time, you know. And then you have to accept your fate a little bit.
Yeah, what's that film where somebody says to somebody else that, what if you've had the best moment in your life already?
Yeah.
What is that?
Wow. I don't know, but that's a brilliant line.
Mm.
It's brilliantly...
how horrible that would be.
Yeah. I mean, I remember thinking to myself when I was younger, I said, I wouldn't mind not necessarily dying too young, but if I could have 10 good years, 10 great years.
Yeah.
You know, I suddenly kind of realized, and I was like, I think I was in my mid-20s or something at the time, and thought, if I had 10 great years where everything went my way, God, I kind of...
Would you recognize it as the apex of your life, though, do you think?
Would you?
You'd probably think this is going to carry on forever.
Well, maybe. Yeah, that's a really good point. And maybe sometimes, and then sometimes, the time of their time, people don't realize that until they're older. Maybe that comes when they're in retirement. Who knows? But I think in the case of this song, which is so telling, is that it's that kind of prime of your lifetime where things really go your way and you think you're the cock of the north, that kind of thing. But the reality is, and I think one of the other things that maybe Briggs didn't mean this in this book, but it's kind of telling, is irrespective of how kind of naive Jim and Hilda are, you know, they're a couple who love each other and it's them against the world. It's
literally they've got quite an idyllic life, haven't they?
They've got a lovely little idyllic life. And they're also, as a lot of pensioners are, who live, especially who live in the countryside, they're kind of isolated. And they're looking out for each other, which is very sweet in a way. And it's them against the world. And Jim's kind of a stoic little sod who's lived through the Second World War. And he's thinking, right, I'll show we're going to bloody get through this. We're going to. And it's beyond their rationale, really.
Yeah, so obviously he's quite optimistic. She's just behind the door, shall we say.
Tim's deluded.
Yeah, so he's very optimistic. He's confident because he keeps saying this thing, doesn't he, that the government know best, and he puts all his faith in the government.
I think that's a brilliant political statement as well that Briggs is making throughout this. She's brilliant. You know, it's having that faith in the elites and in government.
Yeah.
And that is very much an old guard thing. That's very much an older working class thing. Well, then again, the working classes of this country fell into the trap yet again when Brexit came along, because they put their faith in the establishment and the establishment shat all over them. Yeah. You know,
you're right. He is trying to make this point that how international politics impacts on little obedient subjects who don't know the rosh and their elbow, really.
Yeah.
No idea what's going to happen. And his optimism over the coming days and weeks after the bombs dropped, things start to get difficult and the hell starts to deteriorate because of the fallout, and it's not working out how he expected it to be. But at first, he's trying to stay in the fallout shelter, isn't he? He's telling Hilda that, oh, we have to stay in here for two weeks. But then I think he wakes up one day and she's just left it, hasn't she? Gone to the bog or something.
Yeah, yeah.
He's cleaning up and... So he starts wondering about it. So they've just like completely forgot all the advice.
Yeah.
Not that it's necessarily going to do him any good. And they're sort of trying to carry on with the day.
Yes, they do.
You know, and there's one part where they're expecting the paper boy.
That's right.
Aren't they? You know, he should be here with the paper soon. We'll find out what's going on. Then they get the sun loungers out.
They get the garden. Well, this is it. And they go outside and look at what the world looks like outside.
Is it completely black or?
Well, no, initially it's kind of bright. You know, you go is out it? There and right. It's still quite bright. You go, oh, look, the leaves have all gone off the apple tree, ducks. Yes, what a shame. Still, it'll be a lovely spring. Is it spring, dear? The heat has affected the hedge and everything's like, the hedge has gone.
Yeah.
And everything's like this bright. But as they get out on the loungers, here comes this dark filth over the sun. They take themselves inside. They're getting irradiated. This is the thing. Yeah, they don't even realize it's happening. They start making themselves egg and beans as well. They're trying to live kind of create some normality around this madness, aren't they?
There's one bit where he puts on the TV hoping to see our bomb, as he calls it. And he's like dead surprised that it's completely dead. Same with radio.
Yeah.
You know, and then he discovers that there's no water or electricity.
Yeah, there's nothing.
But he thinks the government have turned them off to preserve them.
Yes.
So we think, oh, that's a good idea. Yes, yes, I can understand why they've done that. You know, we'll be all right. Yeah, so they just carry on like this for a bit until the radiation does start to make them really sick, and the hair starts falling out, and the gums are bleeding. They've got sores all over them, and they're just feeling totally, utterly shit and lethargic. And
again, when this happens, they're deluded in this.
Yeah.
They have no understanding what's happening. She goes, I'll be all right in the morning. And, you know, even when she's like pulling bits of her hair out and stuff, it's so tragic.
Well, that's it. Because I think Hilda's gums are bleeding, but she blames it on ill-fitting dentures.
And it's like, oh, you know, put the kettle on, ducks. We're not feeling.
And then they go, oh, we've got no water. So they're actually dying of thirst, aren't they?
Dying of thirst.
And
yeah.
Did they try to eat something at one point? It's completely turned into shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just vile. And then Hilda starts getting really sick. She can't keep things down. Starts vomiting. You know. And Jim's like, they're better now, ducks. Better now. It's just so sad.
Yeah, okay. It is a tragedy.
And the last few pages of the book are and it's brilliant how he does it, because it gets paler and paler. You know, the pages as you get towards the end with their face, and then the faces. You know, like, he turns Jim into this almost like little round face with these just little dark blobs for eyes, and his hair, what hair he had, was is falling away, and Hilda looks really terrible. Her hair's falling out.
Yeah, he's almost white, isn't he? He starts off like rosy cheeks and that.
Yeah.
And towards the end, he's virtually white, and there's loads of green, isn't there, in the background and stuff. So I think he's using that to probably emphasise how nauseous they're probably feeling.
Yeah, maybe. That's it.
Or how everything's rotting.
It's terrible, and he's trying to console Hilda by saying, "Oh, you are a baby, a born worrier. Try looking on the bright side, ducks."
Yeah, they still have no idea they're going to die.
No, not a chance.
And they think that the rescue operation is round the corner. They just need to stay strong for that.
And he's put here, he goes, "Look, even I've got funny blotches on my skin, see? And I'm a man." That's what he says. "I'm a man. It's too much tin food," he says.
Yeah.
"That's all it is, too much tin food." And she says, "Yes, Pilchards never did agree with me." She's blaming it on Pilchards out of a tin. They've no idea what's going on. And then she pulls up a skirt and sees all the blotches on her legs, all the cancerous lesions on her leg. And then Jim just goes, "Shall we have a sing-song, dear? Take our mind off it. What's the use of worrying? Back up your troubles in an old kit bag and smile. And as he's singing that, he's got blood dripping out of the corner of his mouth.
I know, that is quite a stark image, that, isn't it?
He's
smiling, but he's unaware of this blood coming from his mouth.
Oh, God, it's so tragic. It really is. Yeah.
And in the end, they end up putting themselves in potato sacks, don't they?
Potato sacks. Apparently
that was something he read.
Yeah.
That protects you from the radiation.
That's it. So they both covered us in the potato sacks. And then on the final page, which is brilliantly sort of ambiguous and bleak, they decide to say a prayer together, don't they?
Yeah. You know. So he starts off by saying the prayer, but then ends up quoting Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah, yeah.
The poem, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because he goes, that's right. Because he goes, oh yes, into the valley of the shadow of death. And he goes, oh, no more, love, no more. And then the final line is, road the 600. That's the final line, which is from, like you say,
You see, I always had an idea that she died first and he buried her in the garden.
So did I.
Really?
That is bloody hell. That is such a Mandela moment, that, mate.
Mm.
That's the Mandela effect.
Yeah.
I thought exactly that. I thought she died and he buried her or tied her up and put us up. That is really weird. I thought that too.
Wow, God, because I bought the film about 5 years ago and I watched it. And when we were doing this, I got the book and I was reading the book. And because it didn't end like that, I thought, oh, maybe that just happens in the film. So I went to watch the film again, thinking it probably does happen that he buries her, but obviously it doesn't. It ends the same way.
Yeah.
Or I think they sort of float up into the sky. There's something like that. Have you seen the film, Dave?
I'm not sure I have, and I think I kind of think I have years ago, but what I tell you something, I really would like to see it. And I'm so glad I bought this copy of it and, you know, had the opportunity to read it a couple of times since we started doing this podcast series, because I just think it's brilliant. I think it's brilliant. The first time I read it recently, I thought, oh, God, the Hilda character's a bit two-dimensional, a bit, you know. But the reality is, I think he's nailed it, to be honest. I think there were characters who were that kind of innocent.
Yeah.
You know, my grandparents were kind of like that. And they would have been about this age when this book was written. You know, we're talking to people in the 70s here who had lived through the Second World War. It's a real throwback for me when I think about it. It was a naivety about it, an innocence. People were more innocent, I think. And they did have more faith in the idea of state and community. And he, you know, they are probably the people that cheered on Churchill, but then also probably voted for Attlee afterwards, because it was kind of like, well, I love Mr. Churchill, and he was great Prime Minister for the war, but Mr. Attlee is going to give us the NHS and look after the people. But they kind of respected all their elites and politicians and the king and the queen and, you know, all that kind of
absolutely,
stuff.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which we are now all cynical of.
Yeah.
So I think it's brilliantly written. And what's great about it as well is when you look at the reviews are so praising of it, but across the board, the left-wing newspapers.
Tony Benn, isn't there?
Yeah, the left-wing.
He doesn't say much. He just says, really good, Tony Benn.
It is. It's fantastic when you read them. Really good.
David Steele, very original and clever, unnerving though it is.
That's it. I mean, it's fantastic.
Claire Rayner.
Yeah. But you've got like the Daily Mail saying.
Barry
Tuck, do you remember? Oh, yeah.
Moving book, a horrifying book, a work of great stature.
It's brilliant, you know. But you've got the Daily Mail saying, whatever your politics, this is the most eloquent anti-bomb statement you are likely to read. That's from the Daily Mail, you know. So it's across the board. And then you've got The Guardian on the other end of the spectrum saying, acute and not patronising, aching with love and bitterness. It is meant to break your heart to some purpose. And, and that's true. It does break your heart to some purpose. I think it's a brilliant piece of work. And I think it's pretty incredible when you can write a small document, if you like, about a very important period in time so succinctly, you know, so tight and succinctly as this, and it lasts the test. And I think it will last the test of time, this, you know. It's quite something, really.
Yeah. Well, you know, when they decided to turn it into a film, Raymond Briggs knew who he wanted to do it, which was this American animator called Jimmy Murakami, who was of Japanese origin.
Right.
And what's quite amazing in terms of a connection is that he was a kid when he was living in America as a kid with his parents. They had moved there. And when the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki went off, well, probably before that, there was lots of anti-Japanese sentiment, and people who were Japanese origin in America were not trusted. So they were all sort of taken to these like camps.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Put there.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think after the bombs were dropped, he and his family left America.
Right.
And but how ironic it is that he ended up, you know, that incident caused him to leave, and he ended up making a film on the nuclear bomb.
That's a brilliant story.
But he's an amazing guy. There's a really good documentary on him with the DVD.
Oh, wonderful. I'm going to look that up now. I'm going to see what I can find. You know, I've just been, because I've had the book, I've been going off the strength of the book and, you know, And you know, I think it's worth calling it a book. It is. It's because it's a substantial piece of literature. It's a really important thing. They probably don't, but the kids should read it in year 10 or whatever in school, as they call it now, in like fourth year or something.
Yeah, or third I never year. Understand what year that is.
I know. Kids. I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? Yeah. It's year 10, year 11 nonsense. It was first year, second year, third year, fourth year, fifth year. And then you went to sixth form, weren't you, kids? But yeah, I just think Mr. Briggs is a genius. And in my eyes, he should be best remembered for this work above and beyond all of the other things.
Yeah, and he wanted it to. It is an angry book, isn't it? It's an angry statement. He wanted it to have that impact. Fortunately, it was. It wasn't dismissed as some quaint, you know, it was seen for what it was. It was a political statement.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And I think people don't get mad enough about stuff. And I think that's another thing that he's pointing out, really, is that British people kind of are very accepting of things. And, well, we're a kind of Jekyll and Hyde society, aren't we? We do protest sometimes. We do actually go crazy and stuff. But it is good to be cross or to be angry about stuff in some ways, and not to be totally in belief of what our state and government say. We do believe in, you know, especially with the proliferation of media and all the media you can get online and things like podcasts, obviously there is much more out there to change your view and sway your opinions on things. But it less so back in the 80s, you know. But this just encapsulates all those ideas so simply, I think. Idea of trusting your government, trusting that idea of the advice given is going to help you when obviously you're just left for dead, basically.
Mm.
And ultimately, the futility of nuclear escalation.
Yeah. Yeah, brilliant. A brilliant book. That's When the Wind Blows. That's episode 4 of our nuclear season. So do you think we're going to do a couple more of these, Dave? You said it's 6-part before.
Well, I think that was, I was, I've given the game away early, haven't I?
I think that's a good number, actually.
Well, I'm kind of going off what you said.
Yeah, I probably did send you a list of 6 things we could do.
I think, there's more territory to go, and there's lots of avenues I'd like to go down with the, I know you know what I'm talking about, but beyond that, of course, there's a wonderful series of films that we could talk about, and yeah, there's much more, isn't there, to talk about, really. Yeah,
absolutely. So one thing just to say is that Iron Maiden wrote a song called When the Wild Wind Blows, which is partly based on this book, and it is about an old couple that are fearing nuclear war. But the twist in the story is that they actually kill themselves because they think that the bomb has been dropped, but it turns out that it's an earthquake.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things he'd love to talk about, because I kind of wonder whether something like Stephen King's The Mist is almost like an allegory or a metaphor for nuclear war as well. The absolute sort of nihilism of it all in the end. But then again, Stephen King didn't write that ending, did he? That was Frank Darabont that wrote the ending of The Mist.
Oh, right. I've not seen that film, actually. I know you've...
Oh, God, I better not. Yeah. God, I nearly spoiled it then. If you haven't seen it, you've got to see The Mist, mate.
Yeah.
That's great.
Oh, yeah, and David Bowie did the the theme song for the film, and I think he was supposed to do an album, but for some reason he didn't, and Roger Waters took over.
Right.
He wrote most of the soundtrack, I think.
Wow. Yeah. I've got to see the film.
Who better, really?
I've really got to see the film of When the Wind Blows. I mean, Roger Waters, man. The ledge. But Bowie, of course, did the intro to The Snowman, didn't he?
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he does the intro. He sort of almost like claims to be the boy at the start of, and he comes on, and then it goes into the original version has Bowie coming on initially to talk about his childhood, and then it goes into the cartoon.
Ah. Uh-huh.
Yes, there you are.
Knew that, yeah.
But Briggs, man, what a ledge.
Yeah, and it does leave you with quite a sad feeling, doesn't it? Reading the book and watching the film, and it does stay with you, and it, you know, it is one thing. If you did read it when you were a kid, you never forgot, like many other things related to this subject.
Without doubt, pal. Aching with love and bitterness, it's meant to break your heart. And that's what it does, it breaks your heart.
Yeah, betrayal. That's what it is, isn't it? It's a big, it's a massive betrayal.
Well, it's a betrayal of the powers that be with us, with the little people, isn't it? And that's,
yeah.
It's a betrayal on the little guy. It's always about the power brokers and how they affect us. So there's so much in this thin little cartoon novella to go at, to reflect on.
Yeah. So, yeah, we'll wrap up there, but hope you enjoyed it. Thank you, as ever, for listening. Please send us comments. Please send us your views on this. And please like and subscribe, motherfuckers.
Like and subscribe.